Stay tuned for KORC News, Music, and Civics, coming up next on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. You can stream the station worldwide at korcfm.com, where you can also make a secure online donation and support community radio that is here for generations to come in Corvallis, korcfm.com. Throughout the afternoon, it's going to be overcast with areas of rain. Highs today will be at around 53, with winds from the southwest reaching 10 to 15 miles per hour at times. Tonight, the showers will continue, becoming a steady light rain overnight with lows at 46 and a moderate breeze. We can expect showers for the next couple of days, though by Wednesday, it looks to be partly cloudy and then sunny by Thursday through the coming weekend. Highs are expected at around 82 on Friday and Saturday. Today's high will be at 53. Stay with us for KORC News Music. Today's high will be 53 degrees. Stay with us for KORC News Music and Civics. Next on KORC.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
From May 4th to the 12th, the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition is hosting a series of free events for the 15th annual Natural Areas Celebrations Week. Here are some events happening this week. On Sunday, May 5th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., there is the Corvallis Spring Garden Festival at the Arts Center Plaza on Madison between 7th and 8th Streets. A variety of vendors will have seeds, garden starts, art, food, and more for sale, plus performances from local musicians. From the 6th through the 10th, the Hest Haven Nature Center is hosting an open house where you can see their bird museum and an exhibit on the conservation of the western bluebird in the Willamette Valley. Hest Haven is located at 8590 Oak Creek Drive. On May 8th at 4 p.m., there will be a kid-friendly Bio Blitz nature hunt at Avery Park, hosted by Corvallis Environmental Center, with both app-supported and technology-free surveys of living organisms in the park. On May 9th at 7 p.m., an online webinar will be held on the future of Mary's Peak with presenters from the U.S. Forest Service and the Mary's Peak Alliance. More info on the Natural Areas Celebration Week and on all these events can be found at sustainablecorvallis.org. This is KORC 105.9 LPFM, streaming worldwide at korcfm.com.
Oregon Republicans are going to visit the Arizona-Mexico border to solve all our problems in Oregon, or so they say. 13 current lawmakers and 3 candidates will tour the border with personal or campaign funds. Yes, if you donated money to one of these putative lawmakers, your hard-earned donation is being used for what, exactly? According to this group, which is about one-third of all Republican lawmakers in the Oregon legislature, a lax border 1,000 miles to our south worsens the drug crisis in Oregon. Many of this group signed a letter to Texas Governor Greg Abbott earlier this year praising his standoff with the Biden administration over border issues. Abbott, as you may know, has erected razor wire on the border, bused tens of thousands of undocumented migrants to Democratic cities thousands of miles from the border, and blocked the Border Patrol from accessing some land. State Senator Tim Knopp of Bend said the group's letter to Abbott led to more connections with colleagues in Arizona and Texas, which garnered an invitation to Arizona. Knopp said Oregonians should be concerned about illegal immigration and drug smuggling, even if it's 1,000 miles away. To quote Knopp, "There's significant danger there." This in spite of researchers who say immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than American-born residents. Federal law enforcement reports that while the southern border is a significant drug smuggling route, most of the drugs are brought in by highly organized Mexican crime groups, not immigrants and asylum seekers. While the legislature was dealing with abortion and transgender health care, Knopp led the Senate Republican six-week walkout in 2023. That means he can't return to the Senate until 2025 because voters approved a constitutional amendment barring striking lawmakers from re-election. He expects Oregon Republicans to introduce bills related to border security, though what effect they could have when the federal government controls immigration and Democrats control Oregon's legislative and executive branches. Jonathan Lines, a Yuma County, Arizona supervisor, will lead the tour, which includes border barriers, a local hospital, and food bank. He said he has fielded many requests from elected officials, mostly Republican, but also independent presidential candidate Robert Kennedy Jr. Another Republican, Representative Greg Smith of Heppner, no, not Mary Lou Heppner, is joining the trip because he wants Oregon to help keep the bad guys out. He's trying to figure out the connection between the southern border and the limited authority of Republicans in Salem. Most importantly, Smith will deliver an Oregon flag to Arizona. This, of course, won't include football bragging rights since the Arizona universities have fled the Pac-12 and immigrated to the Big 12, which is actually 16 schools, but that's another story. Democrats immediately responded with the tag of campaign stunt. But this kind of stunt plays well in Milton Freewater. Hannah Howell, director of the House Democrats' campaign arm, said Democrats are staying in Oregon to fix Oregon's problems and invited Republicans to join them. She said Republicans are inventing a reason to bring divisive national problems to Oregon, problems they don't know how to solve in our state. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries has announced the latest changes to the minimum wage rates, which will take effect on July 1, 2024. Based on an increase in the Consumer Price Index of 3.5% from 2023 to 2024, the new standard minimum wage will be increased by 50 cents per hour for a total of $14.70 per hour. The Portland Metro minimum wage will consequently be $15.95 per hour. This is within the urban growth boundary, which includes parts of Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. And more information on this can be found on oregon.gov on the Bureau of Labor and Industries webpage. The non-urban minimum wage will now be $13.70 per hour. Non-urban counties in Oregon include Baker, Coos, Crook, Curry, Douglas, Gilliam, Grant, Harney, Jefferson, Klamath, Lake, Malheur, Morrow, Sherman, Umatilla, Union, Wallawa, and Wheeler counties. This information was reported on nonprofitoregon.com.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program you can hear Sundays from 1 to 2, and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis. This is Dan Krall, and I am joined by Elizabeth Jones. She is one of the head cooks, as well as the president of the board, and the executive director of Stone Soup here in Corvallis. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about what Stone Soup does?
Stone Soup is very proud of the fact that we serve a meal every single day, 365 days a year. And we have been serving meals since 1982. And it started off with one meal a day. And then they added another meal and so forth. And then in 2005... we got another meal site. The Stone Soup started at St. Mary's Catholic Church, and in 2005, First Christian Church in downtown Corvallis added the three meals, making it a seven-day meal schedule.
Where does the food come from?
The food comes from a variety of sources. We get I'm estimating about 40% of our food from Lynn Benton Foodshare, and we get the remainder, either we purchase the food or we glean it from very generous providers in Corvallis, especially Trader Joe's, who is immensely generous. But we also, in the summer times, get food from Sage Gardens, which is the nonprofit Starker Arts Park garden, as well as the Sharing Gardens in Monroe. And we also, I've been gleaning recently, I started as president in late last year, and I've started going to the farmers market and gleaning there on Saturdays as well. And the local farmers have been extremely generous in donating their leftover produce to our meals.
What does a typical dinner at Stone Soup look like?
I can tell you about last night's last night's dinner. I was cooking last night, and we made a tomato white bean soup with scallions, and we made a chicken pot pie, and we made a tofu pot pie for the vegetarians, and we made a large green salad, and then we did for dessert a chocolate cake with pears.
Sounds fairly luxurious, especially if you're hungry.
Yeah, we really try to create a full, very sustaining meal with always protein, whether that's chicken or beef, ground beef, or last week we used ground turkey. And that the meat largely comes from Lynn Benton Foodshare. And sometimes 4-H clubs have donated meat to us as well. So we're open to that kind of thing. And then we always try to have fresh vegetables and salad and a dessert as well. So it's a full meal.
And you all started in 1982, which is some time ago. And while you are available at two church locations currently in Corvallis, is this a religious organization?
No, this is not a religious organization. It was started at St. Mary's, as you correctly said. But when we became a nonprofit in 2005, we became non-denominational. So we have no religious affiliation at all, and there are no barriers. Anyone can come and ask for a meal, and we don't only serve the people who are unhoused in Corvallis. I think a chunk of our diners or our guests are unhoused, but by no means all. So we have some older people who are perhaps on low income, or students, or just anyone who wants a free, full, hot meal. And we don't ask any questions. You just get in line and we'll serve you a meal. And it's as simple as that. It's very simple.
As of right now, where are the current locations where Stone Soup is served?
All right. The current locations right now are... Mondays we serve dinner at St. Mary's, and Tuesdays we serve a dinner at First Christian Church. Wednesdays is lunch at St. Mary's. Thursdays is dinner at the First Congregational Church over on West Hills. And Friday is lunch at St. Mary's. Saturdays are brunch at First Christian, and Sundays are dinner at First Christian. So we serve in three different locations, and we cook in two. We cook at St. Mary's and at First Christian. So it's a little bit complicated, because on Thursdays we need to cook the meals at St. Mary's, and then we have volunteers who are terrific and who pick the meals up and then deliver them across town to First Congregational Church, and that's where we're serving, because they have a larger dining area that we needed on Thursdays.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Jones, who is the president of the board, as well as the executive director, and one of the head cooks for Stone Soup in Corvallis. And you all do have a website, correct?
Oh, yes, we do. It's stonesoupcorvallis.org, and there's a lot of information for anyone who might be interested in either donating food or donating their time, of course, as well as funds.
I had received an email in the past week, or I should say maybe, I guess it would have been late April. This recording is taking place in early May of 2024, but I saw that you all are now looking for a new location.
Yes, we are. At the very end of April, and I think it was April 23rd, I was informed that St. Mary's will no longer be in the position to offer us their kitchen and dining facilities. So that means that we're losing Monday, Wednesday, Friday cooking facilities, kitchen facilities, as well as dining. And then Thursday, that's where, as I mentioned, we cook there on Thursdays as well. So it was a surprise, and that means that we're scrambling a bit because we need to be out of St. Mary's completely by July 1st. And that's to make way for a new school, a new high school that St. Mary's is opening in the fall.
Who are you hoping, what kind of a facility are you hoping will open up?
Right now we are, the board met just a couple of days ago, and so we were looking at short-term solutions, of course, because we have only 2 months to find a new place. And we're serving about 450 meals because not only do we have 60 to 70 diners at St. Mary's on those Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but we also send 40 meals that day to the men's shelter. And on Thursdays, we send 40 meals to the men's shelter as well as 12 meals to Jackson Street Youth. So it's a pretty large portion of our services that we're losing. So the board met then to talk about how we could find a place to both cook and serve our meals, or if necessary, separate the cooking and serving, because that's again what we're doing on Thursdays. So we discussed a range of possibilities, perhaps another church, but it has to be a commercial kitchen, it has to be a licensed kitchen. And then ideally we are looking for a space with a commercial kitchen and the space for our diners to come in and sit and enjoy a meal where it's warm and safe and welcoming to them, the way they do at First Christian and at St. Mary's presently. So it's a big lift.
You're hearing the voice of Elizabeth Jones, who heads up Stone Soup in Corvallis. And I can definitely say when you're under the gun to find a new location, that can sometimes lead to scrambling and maybe not always finding the most ideal situation. So there is a chance that someone out there listening may have a lead or an otherwise a possibility for Stone Soup Corvallis to be able to continue doing the work that it does. If you could give us the website to your organization one more time.
It's stonesoupcorvallis.org, or they can get in touch with me directly, and that email is director@stonesoupcorvallis.org.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC. I'd like to thank you again for your time today, and best of luck in finding a new location.
Thank you very much. And I should say we've already had a great deal of offers of ideas, I should say. Nothing has panned out yet, but we've had a lot of, we've had a very welcoming and supportive public response to our problem. So we're hopeful that we can find a solution.
This is Alex Huff for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, and you are hearing the sounds of a jubilant community of skateboarders in downtown Corvallis celebrating the opening of a hard-won expansion to the Eric Scott McKinley Skate Park. In January of 2022, the Corvallis Planning Commission voted to approve a new Corvallis skate bowl at the Eric Scott McKinley Skate Park. With the help of Oregon-based Dreamland Skate Parks and the Benton County Skateboarding Alliance, the new bowl has finally opened in 2024. McKinley was a modest skate park built in the year 2000. In response, the Benton County Skateboarding Alliance was formed to set Corvallis on the path toward a more professional skate park. It was a long and difficult journey that included many meetings, proposals, and fundraisers. Altogether, it took about 16 years to make this bowl happen. On April 27, 2024, the ribbon was cut for the official opening of the new 2,812-square-foot advanced-level skate bowl, right next to the existing bowl, now geared for beginner and intermediate skaters. This project has added a total of 3,000 square feet to the park as a whole. Here is Parks and Rec Director Meredith Pettit just before the ribbon was cut.
The story of this project is really, I like to say, one of patience and perseverance. And it was a true community partnership, a real grassroots effort. I'm sure many of you out here in the audience were part of that and remember probably many years ago really dreaming about what this place could be like. And that grassroots effort turned into a nonprofit organization. And lots of time put into planning, dreaming, getting the community involved, and a lot of advocacy on behalf of Benton County Skateboarding Alliance.
Just then you could hear a skater yelling, "Thanks, Vaughn," and that is to Vaughn Bowser, the president of the Benton County Skateboarding Alliance. This expansion cost a total of $390,000, with at least $63,000 of that coming from either cash or in-kind professional service donations. The skate park is open from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily in downtown Corvallis, where Southwest 2nd Street terminates at Southwest B Avenue. Skateboarding is one of the more accessible sports for people without a large income and, with the increased use of helmets and padding, is an activity that can be enjoyed at nearly any age. Though the new bowl is designed for advanced skaters, there are stairs leading into the bowl for those who would rather start at the bottom and work their way into the high verticals. In other words, you do not have to commit to dropping straight down into the 10-foot bowl in order to use it. It has been designed to also allow BMX riders and those in adaptive sports equipment such as sports wheelchairs. More information can be found on CorvallisOregon.gov. I'm Alex Huff for KORC News, Music, and Civics.
If you're looking to get involved at KORC, you can email info@korcfm.com. Maybe you'd like to help report the news, share your music collection or ideas, and help KORC continue to serve Corvallis. info@korcfm.com is our email. And if you'd like to head over to the chat room at our website, it is at korcfm.com/chat.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. This is Dan Krall, and next we are going to hear some audio from a visit by Dr. Cornell West to Oregon State University. The program topic was Difficult Conversations, the University's Role in Restoring Civic Dialogue, and it was with Dr. Cornell West and Dr. Robert George. This was on January 22nd when Dr. George and Dr. West joined OSU for a conversation focused on the role of higher education in restoring civic dialogue. The discussion addressed the urgent need for universities to lead the way in reviving the art of civil discourse in a society that is increasingly characterized by division and confrontation and polarization. The following audio was recorded on January 22nd, and a thanks goes out to Oregon State University for allowing KORC to broadcast this audio.
Anytime I get a chance to be in Socratic dialogue with my dear brother Robbie, it is a joy. And it's not a matter of just colleagues. It's not a matter of just two academics coming together. It's even deeper than friendship. He is my brother, that his family's part of my family, that we're able to affirm each other's humanity even when he's wrong, even when I'm wrong, you see. But see, in my own case, Robbie knew my mother, Irene,
yes.
B. West.
Wonderful.
Just, I'll never be half the human being that she was. You never get a chance to meet my father. I've met his magnificent parents, and they're in their
98, my dad.
Exactly.
World War II.
Exactly. Good God Almighty. Just gems and jewels. And I say that because one of the reasons why I was so glad to be able to have Robbie being the person I wanted to talk to was because he actually enacted for me the anthem of black people, which is lift every voice. It's not lift every echo. You can't find your voice like a jazz woman or a blues man unless you are honest with yourself. Come to terms with your own wounds and bruises and scars and transfigure them into something that is as distinctive as your fingerprint. So I wanted to be in dialogue with a colleague at Princeton who was not one who was just looking to say something or posing and posturing because they were afraid of the forces of conformity. So they would look good in the eyes of a crowd, that he thinks for himself, Socratic. He musters the courage to think critically, not just talk about it, but think critically. And then at the same time, be able to connect it with what is distinctively him in terms of his tradition. He comes out of a very rich Catholic tradition. And I'm hang loose Baptist. So, he'd got Aquinas, and I'm with Pops, and I'm with Kierkegaard, and Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer, you see, some of that. But we're still within the Christian tradition, but we have this fantastic conflict and contestation going on. But I knew that I was going to have a genuine conversation with somebody. Because when you say what you mean and mean what you say and don't just pose and posture and act as if you're just checking to see what others are saying, a thermometer rather than a thermostat. And we have too many echoes in the culture. Too many thermometers. Everybody got to watch a certain television show, listen to a certain folk, then to say what they think. No, I want to know what you think. Yeah. What is your independent argument, independent story, independent analysis, independent vision, and what I love about this, brother, independent vocation. He's got a calling. He doesn't have a brand. I want to say this especially to the precious young folk of all colors and genders and sexual orientations here at OSU. Please have a cause that's deeper than your brand. Your brand is just a market strategy that allows you to project yourself in such a way that you can engage enough with mobility and maybe live a life in some vanilla suburb, feeling good about yourself, self-satisfied. Where is the noble discontent, the critical discontent that has to do with a wrestling inside of your soul on the battlefield of your soul? And then you emerge with a cause. And the cause is something you live for. It's like loving your mama, that ain't no brand. And loving your child, that's no brand. That's a cause, you live and die. And Brother Robbie's conservative brother, absolutely. So his conception of his cause overlaps with mine, and then other times we clash. And it can be intense clash. We have intense disagreements. But what underlies that disagreement is trying to enact some integrity, honesty, and decency before the worms get our bodies, because we're not here that long. And to do it in such a way that we build on the legacies of those who came before. We both have deep senses of history, of traditions, and of trying to keep them vital and keep them vibrant, as it were. And for 20 years now, it's been almost a miracle, because every time we have a conversation, it's fresh. It really is. It never gets stale. You feel the same thing?
Same way.
It just, sooner or later, it's got to get stale, man. I mean, let's just be honest about it.
The world's serving up new stuff for us all the time.
We crack vessels like everybody else, you know. We're just trying to love our crooked neighbor with our crooked hearts.
So you had some magic right at the start. How do we engage in civil discourse when we don't have that place of trust yet? Can you tell us how you build? Sounds like trust is really important. How do we build that into our conversation so we can talk to people who are so different from us?
Well, I certainly think you're right about the importance of trust, Anor.
Absolutely.
If you don't trust each other, you're not going to be able to reveal yourselves to each other. You're not going to be able to be vulnerable You're not going to be able to take a chance. Speak what you really have in your heart. You put up these defensive barriers. And it means you won't listen. It shuts down thinking, not just relationships. It shuts down thinking. Now, it is true that you need some commonality. Mm-hmm. If you're going to engage differences, politics, religion, ethics, culture, if you're going to engage differences, you need some common ground. Now, what can supply that common ground? It can be different things in some respects, but one thing in a serious intellectual conversation that is a sine qua non, it's got to be there or you're not going to have a meaningful conversation, and that is that both parties have to be concerned with truth, have to be committed to truth. And where things go awry is when we frail, fallen, fallible human beings make the mistake of falling so deeply in love with our own opinions, whatever they happen to be, that we favor them over truth. Now, here's what I mean. We get so deeply in love, deeply bound up with, deeply tied to the opinions we happen to have at the moment, that we would rather not be dislodged from those opinions, even for the sake of truth. We want to have the comfort of feeling we've already got the truth. Now, nobody's got the truth fully. Nobody's got the truth perfectly. Both Cornell and I are believers in truth and its importance. We're not relativists. We're not skeptics. We're not subjectivists. But we also know that we can at best grasp the truth partially, try to deepen our understanding of it. We're never going to get it completely. We're never going to get it without some admixture of error because we're fallible. Now, if we're going to do something about that error, if we're going to make some progress in our minds, get some of that error out, get more truth in, we need to be willing to engage somebody who criticizes us or criticizes our opinions, challenges us. Otherwise, we're just going to relate to people and engage with people who keep confirming us in what we already believe. When that happens, they'll confirm you in what you believe that happens to be true, but they'll also confirm you in what you believe that's false. Now, this is no big secret I'm about to let you in on, but all of us sitting up here on the stage and all of you out there and everybody else in this entire world, right at this moment, this very moment, has some untrue beliefs in their head. Is there anybody out there who has only true beliefs in your head? No untrue beliefs. No, that's right, because we're all fallible. We know some of what we believe isn't true. Here's the problem. We don't know which ones are untrue, which beliefs are untrue, and which ones are true. And we also know, now you tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that we know that we could be wrong. We have untrue beliefs, not only about the minor, trivial, superficial things in life. We can easily have, and undoubtedly do have, some untrue beliefs about the profound, important things in life. Matters of the human good, human dignity, human decency, human rights. I don't think you tell lies accidentally. If you say something happens to be false, but you believe, that's not a lie. You don't defraud somebody accidentally. You might charge them the wrong amount, but as soon as you recognize it, you rectify the situation. You don't bear false witness against your neighbor accidentally. But it's different with being zealots for bad causes. There's nobody who deliberately becomes a zealot for a bad cause. They believe their cause is a good cause. That's why they become zealots for it. And yet, the wisdom of the liturgy reminds us that we, being fallible, can be zealots for bad causes. That should put the fear of God in us. That should make us always open to the friend who, disagreeing with us, is willing to do us the profound favor, the service, the good of challenging our opinions, even our most deeply held, cherished opinions, because we could be wrong about it. We don't think we are when we're fighting for the cause. We're fighting for it because we believe it's just. And neither Cornell nor I want you to shut down your service to the causes you believe in. But don't just be careful not to wrap your emotions so tightly around your convictions that you become a dogmatist, a zealot, an ideologue. You need to require, you need to keep some measure of distance between your identity and the beliefs you happen to hold. And that's tough because we do cherish our beliefs, especially our beliefs about the important things, religion, politics, morality, and so forth. But we still need some distance if we're to be genuine truth seekers, if we're to have that common ground of a commitment to truth to have our conversation on. There's a reason for civility, and it's not just to be nice to each other. And it's not just so that we don't kill each other. Those are important, those are good. But the most fundamental reason for civility is you need it to get at the truth of things. If you're serious about truth, you want civility, not mere politesse, not mere politesse where I listen politely while you talk at me, and then you listen politely while I talk at you. That's not real engagement. Civility is not just politely listening. It's not politesse. Civility is genuinely engaging, genuinely listening, considering that the other person might be right and I might be wrong. The other person might be partially right and I might be partially wrong. So it's that common ground, Honora, that I think is absolutely critical. It's certainly right at the foundation of what we do. And I don't see how you can do without it in the business of true civil discourse. Mm-hmm.
And what special role does higher education play in that process? What should we be doing in higher education, maybe better than we're currently doing? Or, you know, what do you think higher education can do to improve civil discourse?
Yeah, I mean, for me, higher education is just one context alongside other contexts. So I don't want to begin with an assumption that somehow higher education has some shortcut to virtue. As long as there's human beings involved,
that's right,
it's going to be a mess. It's true. We just cracked vessels, you know. We are a wretched species. Let's just be honest about it. We really are. From the very beginning, from the emergence of the caves up to now, most of the history of the species is the history of organized greed and institutionalized hatred, of routinized indifference toward the vulnerable, of domination, of oppression and exploitation. And then we have these moments of interruption, a grin and a hug. Moments of interruption. Mom loves you and you love her. Institutional moments of interruption. Democratic experiments, which tend not to last too long because the citizens have to be so virtuous civically, so courageous morally to reproduce the best or produce tyranny. So that's my starting point. So then the question becomes, well, what is the distrust really about? Distrust is often the fruit of desperation and despair. You see, just like the sister who was talking about the Palestinians when we earlier on, right? There's an assumption that, well, they're having a conversation and they're really indifferent to what's happening with Palestinians or indifferent of what's happening in the Middle East. As if genocide is vicious or ethnic cleansing as vicious as it is, somehow will stop conversation because the conversation is one that is so indifferent to what I'm concerned about, and I'm so despairing about the situation that I have a distrust. Well, that makes all the sense in the world. And the question becomes, well, what are the countervailing forces against distrust? Well, Kierkegaard again, just to bring in some of we Protestant insights here. I mean, Aquinas is all right, you know, but the opposite of distrust, it's a leap of faith. Now, it's not necessarily a theological leap, but you have a leap of faith in other people that says, of course, distrust is understandable given the desperate situation that many human beings find themselves, but you have to have enough courage to make a leap even in a conversation, to say, I'm going to be vulnerable enough for this moment to see whether I can learn something or convey something to you so that maybe together we can be a stronger force for good.
That was the voice of Dr. Cornel West when he visited Oregon State University on January 22nd at the LaSalle Stewart Center with a dialogue with Dr. Robert George. Thanks to Oregon State University for allowing KORC to broadcast an excerpt of that recording. Thanks for joining us today on KORC News, Music, and Civics. This program can be heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m., and now every Monday from 5 to 6 p.m. You can also go to KORCFM.com, where you can listen to archived Sunday news programs. Thanks for joining us today.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Every week, KORC is pleased to bring you segments from Democracy Now!, which have been edited down to about 15 minutes per segment. You'll be listening to national and international news that can indirectly affect you as a Corvallis resident. This segment is from Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. For more information, go to democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Students at Columbia University occupy Hamilton Hall and rename it Hind Hall after the six-year-old Palestinian girl Hind Rajab, killed by Israeli soldiers in Gaza. Other Columbia students face suspension as they continue their Gaza solidarity encampment. As police crack down on student protesters around the country, Democracy Now! Went to Columbia to speak to professors and students.
Hundreds of our students have been disciplined over the past 6 months on unfair premises. We're willing to put a lot on the line for this cause. My right to education shouldn't come before the right to education of Gazans.
We'll also speak with genocide scholar, Brown University professor Omer Bartov, about allegations of anti-Semitism by protesters and the weaponizing language. He was at the UPenn encampment, and an Israeli airstrike in Gaza has killed the oldest daughter and the baby grandson of the prominent Palestinian poet and academic Rafat El-Arir, who himself was killed in an Israeli airstrike in December. We'll speak with the friend of the family, Jihad Abu Salim.
Rafat wrote, "If I must die, you must live to tell my story."
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Students at Columbia University took over Hamilton Hall just after midnight, after the school began suspending students who refused to leave the Gaza Solidarity encampment, which began almost 2 weeks ago. The hall was also the site of an historic student occupation in 1968. Students have renamed the building Hind Hall in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old Palestinian girl killed by the Israeli military in Gaza. Police across the country are continuing to crack down on student protesters calling for an end to Israel's assault on Gaza. In Texas, police made at least 100 arrests Monday at a student-led encampment at the University of Texas, Austin. Earlier this morning, police raided an encampment at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, arresting at least 25 people. In California, officials at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, have closed the school's campus for the rest of the semester in an effort to shut down a student occupation. Meanwhile, at the New School here in New York, students have expanded their protests by occupying the lobby of the Parsons School of Design. Students at the Fashion Institute of Technology are continuing their encampment in their school lobby as well. New protest encampments have begun at a number of schools, including the University of Chicago and the University of Oregon. Campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza have also spread overseas, including Sorbonne University in Paris, where students said they were inspired by the protests at Columbia.
I think that today we have the same concern as elsewhere, as at Columbia, as at Sciences Po, and how it has been happening for 6 months. We're denouncing what we are seeing before our eyes, that is to say, the genocide of the Palestinian people, which is being committed by the State of Israel with the active complicity of the French government. Not just the French, of course, but as this is our government, in my opinion, we must denounce it.
Democracy Now! Goes to Columbia University after headlines to speak with students and professors. The student protests come as the death toll in Gaza's top 34,500, including over 14,500 children. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken has arrived in Jordan as negotiations continue over a proposed 40-day ceasefire and a deal to release more hostages held in Gaza. Blinken urged Hamas to accept the current proposal.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly.
Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan criticized Blinken's comment. Hamdan told Al Jazeera, quote, "Stopping the attacks against Palestinians is not generous. The attack itself is a crime. So when you stop a crime, you can't claim that it's a generous action from the Israeli side," unquote. Hamas officials are reviewing the current proposal. Meanwhile, Israel's continuing to attack Rafah and other parts of Gaza. A Palestinian woman, Umfayaz Abu Taha, spoke to a reporter in Rafah while holding an infant after surviving an Israeli airstrike.
"We took her from under the rubble, thank God. She is 2 months old, and thank God. Was she holding a rocket or was she standing near tanks? What's her fault? What would her fault have been if she had been injured or martyred? What would her fault have been?" "The entire world is seeing what's happening to us. They carry out negotiations and things, but we feel like this is all in vain. It's like they're giving us some anesthetic, not more. They carry out negotiations while Israel strikes. Look at us with some compassion, with some humanity. Fear God. This is all we ask for. We're not asking for much. Just end the war, nothing more."
Politico is reporting a group of lawyers, including 20 that work in the Biden administration, are calling on the president to halt military aid to Israel. In a letter, the attorneys write, quote, "The law is clear and aligned with the majority of Americans who believe the U.S. should cease arms shipments to Israel until it stops its military operation in Gaza." The letter also urges the Justice Department to investigate whether war crimes charges could be brought against U.S. citizens serving in the Israeli military. Amnesty International is also calling on President Biden to halt arms sales to Israel. In a new report, Amnesty documents how Israel's used U.S.-supplied weapons to kill Palestinian civilians. The Biden administration's claiming the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction to charge Israeli officials for war crimes. This comes amidst reports the ICC may be close to issuing arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli officials, as well as members of Hamas. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel spoke Monday.
Since this president has come into office, we have worked to reset our relationship with the ICC, and we are in contact with the court on a range of issues, including in connection to the court's important work on Darfur, on Ukraine, on Sudan as well. But on this investigation, our position is clear. We continue to believe that the ICC does not have jurisdiction over the Palestinian situation.
The United States has long criticized the International Criminal Court, but last year, President Biden ordered U.S. agencies to share evidence with the court after it issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin after he invaded and occupied parts of Ukraine. On Capitol Hill, a number of lawmakers, both Republican and Democrat, threatened to retaliate against the ICC if it takes action against Israel. Democratic Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania said, quote, it would be a fatal blow to the judicial and moral standing of ICC to pursue this path against Israel, he said. A group of more than 50 journalism professors have written to the New York Times calling on the paper to commission an independent review of its report that members of Hamas committed widespread sexual violence October 7th. Numerous media outlets have raised questions about the paper's reporting, which was written in part by a freelance Israeli journalist who had liked multiple posts on social media advocating violence against Palestinians. In news from Ukraine, a Russian missile attack on the city of Odessa has killed five and left at least eight people seriously injured. The missile struck the Odessa Law Academy, which is known locally as the Harry Potter Castle. The United States is warning a large-scale massacre could soon occur in the Sudanese city of El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. The city's been a key hub for humanitarian groups, but fighting's begun between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, spoke Monday.
As we speak, the RSF is planning an imminent attack on El Fasher. As I've said before, history is repeating itself in Darfur in the worst possible way. And an attack on El Fasher would be a disaster on top of a disaster. It would put 500,000 internally displaced persons at risk, people who traveled from across Darfur to seek refuge. And that's on top of the 2 million Sudanese who call El Fasher home.
The Washington Post has revealed senior members of India's spy agency were directly involved in a foiled plot to kill a prominent Sikh activist who lives here in New York City. The Washington Post reports the assassination plan was signed off by an officer in India's spy agency, the Research and Analysis Wing. The Post also reports U.S. intelligence agencies believe Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's national security adviser was aware of the assassination plot to kill Gurpatwant Singh Panam, who advocates for an independent state for Sikhs in northern India. Modi's government's denied any involvement, blaming the assassination plot on rogue operatives. An unprecedented heat wave continues to bake large areas of Southeast Asia. Schools have been closed in Bangladesh and parts of the Philippines. The temperature in Burma has reached as high as 118 degrees Fahrenheit. The heat wave is also impacting Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and India. The World Meteorological Organization recently reported the climate crisis impacted Asia more than any other region last year. President Biden's called on Congress again to pass an assault weapons ban after four law enforcement officers, including three U.S. marshals, were shot dead in Charlotte, North Carolina, as they attempted to serve a warrant on a man wanted for firearms possession. Four other officers were wounded in the shootout, which also left the wanted individual dead. Johnny Jennings is the chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department.
About 1:30 p.m. this afternoon, the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force went to the 5,000 block of Galway Avenue in an attempt to serve a warrant on an individual for possession of firearm by a convicted felon. When they approached that individual, they were met with gunfire. Officers returned gunfire and struck the victim, who was later pronounced deceased in the front yard of the residence. As officers approached that individual, they then received additional gunfire from inside of the residence.
And the United Auto Workers and Daimler Truck reached a deal Friday to avert a possible strike at the truck and bus manufacturer in North Carolina. Under the tentative deal, 7,000 workers at Daimler Truck will see their salaries increase by 25% over the next 4 years. This is UAW President Sean Fain.
Time's up for billionaires who think working class people can't stand up for themselves. Time's up for a system of exploitation that destroys lives, that destroys families, and destroys communities. And the clock has run out on corporate greed. Today belongs to the working class.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was an abbreviated segment of Democracy Now! From Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. For more information on national and international news that can affect you as a Corvallis resident, go to democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. We're going to conclude today's program with a song by the late Neil Gladstone, beloved singer, songwriter, musician, poet, and comedian who died of Parkinson's disease April 5th at his residence in Corvallis. This is a song of his called The Best You Can Do. It comes from his album, Mixed Company. You can find more information on Neil Gladstone at his website, neilgladstone.com. That's N-E-A-L, gladstone.com.
When you go up, you're up. When you come down, you're down. Sometimes it takes a life of mistakes to turn you around. Answers are hard to find. One thing I can surely say is from the long view, the best you can do is give your love away. Some of us reach for the stars. Your heart. Nobody knows which way the wind's gonna blow, but one thing I can surely say is from the long view, the best you can do is give your love away. Against a rising tide of greed and confusion, we seem to be our passion, most of us never do. Some of us stand with our hat in our hand, waiting for our dreams to come true. Life is a dangerous game. It's easy to be afraid, but from the long you can do is give your love away. Thank you. can bring you down. Losing or winning, the world keeps spinning around. When you go up, you're up. When you come down, you're down. Sometimes it takes a life of mistakes turn you around. Answers are hard to find. One thing I can surely say is from the long view, the best you can do is give your love away. Yes. From the long view, the best you can do is give your love away.